As you see on your chug list, this slot, the last chug slot on Thursday, it's a bit truncated. Just have to look in, okay? It's a bit truncated because at 6:55 every Thursday night we have a Sichat Musar, which is a rotating Musar Shmuz to end the week, everyone together. So you hear from different Rabbanim, English-speaking Rabbanim, Israeli Rabbanim. But at this slot from 6:15 till around 6:55, we're going to have a rotation. And to help you become more familiar, not just in general with the spirit and the ideas and the hashkafa of the Rosh Yeshiva, but literally their Torah. So one way we'll describe Rav Amital's position on a particular aspect, sometimes relating to the Parsha, sometimes general, sometimes relating to the Yom Tovim. The next week, Rav Lichtenstein. It won't necessarily be a direct rotation. It may be 2 weeks in a row with Amital, 2 weeks in a row with Lichtenstein. But as I alluded to, when I spoke in the Beis Medrash Tuesday night, it's absolutely critical to us that you don't just come here and learn the Yeshiva's Torah and study its values and become inspirited, but to realize the depth of ideas that these two personalities installed within this Yeshiva, the way that it still ricochets and reverberates within the Yeshiva. And I'd like you to see yourselves as, no, we don't, there are no sheets are in the back here, but I'd like you to see yourselves, if anyone needs sheets, take from the back row. I'd like you to see yourselves as Talmidim of Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital through their works, through their Talmidim, as we say in our Tfilos, every Monday and Thursday. What's the difference between a Gadol and a Rebbe? If Baruch Hashem, I'm a Rebbe. I've been a Rebbe for close to 30 years. I've been privileged to teach numerous, multiple Talmidim and hopefully affect their lives and the lives of their families and the lives of their children. But a Gadol, his message and his impact is so deep that they don't just affect Talmidim, but they affect, as we say in Davin, Talmidi Talmidim. Talmidim, Talmidi Talmidim, Mechom Mechom Mosh Voseim. So you are the Talmidi Talmidim of Rav Lichtenstein. I don't expect that I'm going to have Talmidi Talmidim. I don't expect that my impact and influence is going to last so long and so deep that somehow your Talmidim are going to study my Torah. You'll study my Torah and you'll shape your life around it. But someone like Rav Lichtenstein or Rav Amital, they impacted, and you're sensing in the yeshiva, not just the communities you come from and the communities in Israel, but the entire world. The entire Jewish, anywhere there are English-speaking communities, and of course, Hebrew-speaking as well, you feel, you sense their impact. Let me just put it to you a different way. I don't want to get bogged down because I want to start the chug. But ask your Israelis, guys sitting next to you, the Dati Lumi world today, the world that you see represented in the Gush Beis Medrash, many people, these are stereotypes, and you can talk about these stereotypes with them, but sometimes stereotypes are broad reference points. Broadly, they'll divide themselves into two different sub-camps in the national religious world. There's a group of a sub-camp called the Grushnikim, and a group called the Kavnikim. And generally, Grushnikim refers to people who were influenced by the Torah of this yeshiva, other yeshivas that were formed in this image, the Rabbanim who learned here to form yeshivas, Talmidim went on to become Rabbanim. And broadly speaking, Kavnikim refer to people who were influenced by Rav Kook in that franchise of yeshivas. These are broad definitions. Not all the yeshivas are the same. But at this point, the Torah that Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital taught and delivered has become a movement. It's not just a yeshiva and a building, but people identify, shape their lives, build their yeshivas, articulate their worldview based on their Torah. And based on not just the Tosfos interpretation they taught, or the Gemara, or the Shir they gave on Bava Kama, but based on their outlook on life. So we'd like to share that outlook with you. We'd like you to use this session, along with your own study. Rav Lichtenstein's books are now obviously readily available in all languages, or Rav Amital's Svarim, and feel free to take some time, obviously, during the storm that you're making, and study V'aretz Nisan L'Bnei Adam, which is probably the best access point to Rav Amital. Feel free to study Rav Lichtenstein's By His Light, Bi'ur Panecha, or Rav Lichtenstein's interview with Rav Chaim Sabato, the Rosh Hashiva of Malei Adumim, called Mevakshei Panecha. Feel free to read these and to enrich part of your encounter with the Rosh Hashivas with your own personal study. So I'd like to talk about Rav Amital in general tonight and share with you the famous sichot he would give when Elul began. And there were a few famous sichot that everyone waited for throughout the year, milestone sichot. And people would travel specifically to the yeshiva, businessmen, professionals, middle-aged people, to hear Rav Amital's sicha on, to hear the famous Sicha about. And these milestone events were essentially the first day of Elul, when Yeshiva began. I'll describe with you why those were such important Sichot. The Slichos Sicha, and you'll see how Slichos is a convocation and a gathering because it's Masi Shabbos. A lot of alumni travel back late at night for the Slichos in Yeshiva, and Avraham Avital would give that Sicha. He would speak on Rosh Hashanah, and we'll try to share some of that with you as well. The first day of Rosh Hashanah before Mosef, he would speak about the state of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Malchus in our world. After all, today we try to coronate Hashem and see ourselves as subjects of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So has it been a good year for Hashem's Malchus? Has it been a challenging year for Hashem's Malchus? And I'll share with you some of those Sichot. The second day of Rosh Hashanah, obviously, he spoke about Kiddush Hashem and Jewish martyrdom and the Akedah and some of the themes of the Akedah, which we read about. He would speak, of course, Hanukkah, about Jewish sovereignty, because he arrived in Israel on the second night of Hanukkah. He spent the first night of Hanukkah, I think it was in a Cyprus or a Turkish camp, and he literally arrived in Eretz Yisrael during the Chag, that in part we celebrate the restoration of Jewish sovereignty. He would speak on Yom HaTzmaut, obviously, about Zionism and the state of Israel, as well as in Yom Yerushalayim. So those were the 7 or 8 times a year. Obviously, he spoke every Shabbos, but those were the famed. If you were to read, and there's a Sefer call that was put out recently called Eight Ratzon. I don't know what its English translation is. The title, I don't know what the title is. But it's been recently translated to English. That would be a good way for you to study Rav Amital and some of his ideas, at least for Chodesh Elul, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. That Sefer, Eight Ratzon, Eight Ratzon.
When God is near.
When God is near. Okay, so that's what? I'm not sure. Anyway, the Hebrew one is Eight Ratzon, the English one, which I don't own, and I obviously haven't read, but certainly you can, I think you can probably buy it in the office, and buy it online, and that would be a good way to study. Anyway, what did Rav Amital speak about on Rosh Chodesh Elul? What was his Sicha? Everyone gathered the second day, first day, Chodesh Elul, Bet Elul. What was revolutionary about it was that he sensed that this was a transition, and that as a transition was unfamiliar to many boys. And he had to try to help escort them through this very, very unfamiliar passage and encountering ideas they may not have been accustomed to. I imagine that in most yeshivas for the last 200 years, and the yeshiva experience is about 200 years old, there were sichot on Rosh Chodesh Elul. Well, the Sichot were generally, not having studied them, but in my imagination, about the importance of Talmud Torah, the importance of personal growth, of tshuva, whatever. Each yeshiva has its own style and its own flavor. But Rav Amital, when he built this yeshiva, he wasn't just building an institution. He was creating a revolution, and a revolution of consciousness. Hesder didn't exist. You're seeing the outcome of Rav Amital's revolution, and sometimes when a revolution is very successful, you don't realize it's revolutionary because it becomes embedded as a paradigm. There are over 85 Hesder yeshivas today. It didn't exist. You either served in the army, or you went to a range of wonderful Haredi yeshivas, but all of them not allowing, so they're not encouraging army service. And if you wanted to combine the two, it was your own personal blend. You went to yeshiva and you decided when you serve in the army, to institutionalize the two, to merge the two. And a lot of the decisions he took about the yeshiva were with an awareness this was a revolution, he was building a model. We'll talk about that during the year. What are some of the things that we still practice in this yeshiva that are based on his sensing that he was presenting a model to the community of Israel, not just building an institution? But one of the things he was facing was that he was introducing a new experience to families and to children your age who just weren't aware of that. It's not like many of you, for example, you've had brothers, parents, rabbanim. This isn't new to you. This is challenging. This is mind-expanding. This broadens your horizons, your imagination. But the notion of yeshiva, many of you were waiting for this for years. When am I going to go to yeshiva? What am I going to do when I enter yeshiva? What happens when you build it from bottom up, from ground level? And you have to present yeshiva with all the transition to people and boys and families and a cultural milieu which doesn't exist. You're operating in a vacuum. You just create a model. So his Elul Sicha was in part about that. He's speaking to a group of boys who just don't have the cultural generational background that, thank God, we built in our world. Thank God most of you are a product of the second and third generation Hesder movement. But now you're starting without any background information or expectation. And Our Fellow was a chance for him to start to set those expectations. And he quoted a Gemara and a Medrash. The Gemara, source number 2, I apologize for the way the sources are organized. These are images rather than actual sources, but most of my sources will make the channel be a little bit better organized. Source number 2, actually we'll start with source number 3. We're running a little bit late because Rabbi Yitzchak Levi is going to come and give us a shot in about 20-25 minutes. The Gemara says in Brachos, Amar Rav Chisda, source number 3, towards the bottom of the first page. Li'olam yikanes adam shnei psachim bebeis haknesses. You should walk in 2 doors in the Beis haknesses, in short. Shnei psachim, sagabay, you have to walk through 2 literal doors to make sure you walk through 2 doorways. Ela ema shior shnei psachim. A distance that's equivalent to 2 doors. And most of you shown them interpret this literally. You should try to position yourself internally in shul. You shouldn't hang or daven in the periphery of shul. You should walk in as proximate as you can to the bima. I mean, there's a lot to be spoken about on that note. And part of what hopefully we'll train you about is proper tefillah methods. It's very hard to train you for kavana. Quite honestly, kavana during davening is very elusive. And if most of tefillah is predicated on successful kavana, then it's a crapshoot that you'll often lose. Sometimes you have to treat tefillah and say, I will do everything possible to respect tefillah, the way I come to tefillah, my modality for tefillah, the way I dress for tefillah. And certainly this custom or dynamic where you don't really stand in shul, you daven near the door, we spend half of davening near the door, you hang. Part of davening is coming and sitting in a seat properly, spending time in the seat. I know, for example, with my children in shul, I don't let them leave till davening's over, and that means announcements. It's because you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we're sitting in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you respect the moment, you respect the experience. Rav Amital took this statement in Brachos as a metaphor. Rav Amital was great at metaphors, at seeing metaphors within erstwhile halachic statements. And the shir shnei psachim wasn't just halachically how far you have to travel into the shul. Should you be inside the shul itself, or should you be on the periphery? Shir shnei psachim is psychological. When you enter the Beis Hashem, there's this concern about how far you'll enter and what that entails, what that will transform you into. I mean, you're all feeling that, and I spoke about this the other night. This is a very powerful experience. And as inspiring and as impressive as it is, if you're asking yourself honest questions, it's also frightening at many levels. And it's always easier to walk in, dip your feet in the water, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, as I described the other night, and not fully enter shir shnei psachim. Or, as Rav Amital quoted the Medrash, and this is even a more graphic Medrash, so you can turn the page. Source number 4, it's on the back page. Of course, the pasuk in Mishlei, Asher Adam Shomeli, the Medrash says, person who listens to Hashem, Rishkar al Dalsasai, the end of the pasuk, to enter my Dalsas, my doors. So the Gemara says, Al Tamot, 3 lines from the bottom, Ala Pesach Achitza on this pala, don't stand on the other door, Ela having Miskabe Lehikanes, Delas lifnim midelas, the door within the door. So the Gemara's language is shir shnei psachim. The Medrash's language is delas lifnim delas, the door within the door. So it's even more graphic. Imagine the outer door being just whether you're in the Beis Medrash or in your room, whether you arrive in yeshiva or you pass on yeshiva and you go to college. But delas lifnim delas, it's okay, maybe in the Beis Medrash, but where's your heart? Where's your consciousness? Where's your passion? Where's your imagination? How much of that has fully entered? And Rav Amital said, that's legitimate. He's introducing a yeshiva concept to people for whom it's foreign. And the point is, I think even for people for whom it's not foreign. A lot of these questions over the last week, and I'm sure this week has felt like a century, and it will continue to feel that way until you realize, wait a second, my year's over, because it went so fast. And yes, you should have better resources to find out about that, and we'll talk about how to manage your time experientially, not just how to manage your time practically. How to make sure you're holding on to your time and maximizing your time. Rav Amital talked to the Talmidim every year, not just in 1969, when he was introducing Torah to an audience that was unfamiliar with it, but in 1983 when I was here, and in 2002, and in 2010 when he was introducing this notion that it's Elul. And here's the second part about Rav Amital. It's Elul. And he's also validating those concerns. He's not saying, oh, you're a coward. You're not sufficiently engaged. When people talk about Rav Amital's humanism,
Part of what they mean is that he understands that it's all right to be a human being, to harbor fears and concerns and live with them and try to advance them, but don't in any way flagellate yourself or punish yourself because you're not able to reach the level of perfection that maybe in some theoretical realm may be attainable. Remember, someone, I'm not going to embarrass the person, but he's sitting in this room. I'm going to look at him. I mentioned his name, more embarrassing, but that person asked me possibly one of the best questions I ever faced when speaking about the Rosh Hashiva, of the Yeshiva. I speak a lot. I've spoken all over the world, literally. I was giving a hesped for Avraham Lichtenstein on his Yahrzeit. I talked about how aspirational he was and how much he demanded of himself and by extension how much we demanded of ourselves. And whenever he spoke to us about achievements, he would speak down to us. What I mean is, whatever he would expect of us, he would do more, not less. So if he expected us to sleep only 5 or 6 hours a night, he in his prime would sleep 4 hours a night. And he would stand the entire Yom Kippur even as a broken old man, and he would shout Yehi Shmei Rabba at the top of his lungs, and you just felt like you were looking at a Vilna Gaon figure, someone that lived life with such religious drive and such religious gusto, and we'll talk about that, that you just felt almost compelled to be more pious and compelled to be more devout and compelled to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And anything you accomplished was fell short because his standard was so surpassing and so unreachable and unattainable. So a boy who in high school was listening to this eulogy and description raised his hand and said, did you ever get depressed? Did you ever get sad or despondent that maybe you couldn't live up to the expectations that Rav Lichtenstein's example set for you? Which I thought was a phenomenal question. And I gave two answers, but my immediate answer was, that's why we had Rav Amital. Because Rav Amital was always very assuring of the fact that you're a human being and don't deny your humanity and learn to live with flaw. And that's the Hasidic voice in Rav Amital. We'll talk a lot about Hasidus, those who will study it in my shiurim or in other contexts. Hasidus was able to acknowledge the frailty of the human condition and the limitations of religious achievement. And on the one hand, you should be ambitious and try to strive, but also accept the fact that man can't reach perfection in this world. I talked about this morning in the Hasidic shiur. And this was Rav Amital's way of assuring us these feelings, they're natural. And you've even heard that voice in me the last couple of days, in my shiur, and in the way I've been speaking to you. I think there's a little bit in my conscience of Rami Tal, it's all right to be homesick, it's all right to be jet-lagged, it's all right to be hungry, it's all right to be overwhelmed, and this is what happens. And take it at a natural pace, you're not going to be the Vilna Gaon overnight. And the attempt is, on the one hand, to introduce the boys that there is this world of the Beis Medrash, and the values are very different from the outside world, and Rami Tal would speak about some of these values. When Rav Lichtenstein spoke about values, it would take an hour for each value. That's why he spoke for hours. I mean, if Aaron's sichot lasted hours. The only thing I would just mention, he would rifle off the two or three values that he felt were different between the world of the Beis Medrash and the outside world. The outside world is very artificial. Quick judgments. Stereotypes. This is a world in which we're asking you to think very, very deeply about ideas. To ponder them. To deconstruct them. To demystify them. The outside world is very media-driven. And it's still media-driven, but even 40 years ago. And this is a world that we're not looking for attention, we're not looking to grab headlines, but to build your soul. It's not the headlines in the newspaper, or the politicians and the diplomats that will shape your soul, but working very assiduously and very persistently in who you are and your identity. Ramital would speak about a world of a mediocrity. So Ramital, mediocrity, in Hebrew, beinoniut, beinoni. Beinoniut was the curse, the anathema. You have to be excellent. And Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein both believe that excellence is contagious, and that's why you have to try to be excellent in everything you attempt in life. Try to be excellent in all your character developments and all your achievements and all your projects, because if you learn to settle for mediocrity, it's going to spill over to your religion. It's going to spill over to your attempt to become a better Balmidos. And a lot of times there are clashes. So let's say a person will sometimes would ask Rav Aaron, should I spend the extra hour in the Beis Medrash? Or maybe aim a little bit less in my academic studies, so I'll get a B, but I'll have an extra hour to learn the Beis Medrash. Let's assume for time being that B would in no way crimp or handicap the professional advancement. If they won't get into medical school, then that's just a larger question of learning Torah versus preparing yourself professionally. But let's, for example, say you're already in medical school, and you could decide to study a bit less for the test and for the course and spend the extra time in the Beis Medrash. I don't know that many people would even see that as a dilemma. People still saw that as a dilemma on two fronts. First of all, the responsibility and the trust you have to the teacher. You're committed to that teacher to study properly and to respond to the expectations and to the coursework. It would be dishonest and deceitful to that teacher to perform at less than capacity. And second of all, once you train yourself to be an underperformer, then you end up conditioning yourself to be an underperformer. Once you change yourself to be an overperformer, then it tends to spill over into your davening, into your learning, into your bodhis Hashem. So it's a legitimate question. Each person, obviously, different stages of life, different contexts. So Rav Amital talked about some of the values that were different. But most of all, and he quoted this Tosus, and I was talking, I don't know if some of you saw, Adam was watching today, because it's right by Makom, Rav Amital's son in the Beis Medrash today, because they had, if you saw a group of older men in the Beis Medrash today with white beards and gray beards, that was the first group of yeshiva that came back for a day of learning. You'll see a lot of night seders and day seders, a lot of alumni come back to the yeshiva in different formats to learn. So that was the first group, the 1968 group, they came back to learn in the Beis Medrash today. And who was part of that group? Rav Amital's son. So the man I was speaking to without a gray beard was Rav Amital's son. He was Rabbi Inshel Levin and came back to learn in the yeshiva. He spends a lot of time learning the Beis Medrash. So we're talking about Rav Amital's elosicha, and he was saying something, obviously he knew better, I was saying something back and forth. And at the same moment, we both said the following two words, and I'll tell you what those two words meant. Eish HaGedolah. Like, it was literally like you couldn't time it better. He was having his statement, I had my statement, and we said the same thing, and it was a meeting of minds, and we lived that moment as if Rav Amital was right there, because he so impacted our lives. Tosfos and Shabbos, source number 5. It's a little bit disheveled, I apologize. Source number 5. That's an interesting question. There's such euphoria at Har Sinai. The Jewish people respond so enthusiastically. Kol asher diber Hashem naseh v'nishma. Such ecstatic, unconditional eagerness to accept Hashem's help. In that context, why is Hashem lifting the mountain and threatening the Jews, if you don't accept Torah, I'll bury you alive? It's such an anticlimax. It's such a non sequitur to the drama of willful, volitional, eager acceptance. Then Hashem says, by the way, kaf alein harke gigas, I'm lifting the mountain. You don't accept my Torah, I'll bury you. So many answers to that question. It's not the first time that question was posed. But Tosfos has an interesting line. Kaf aleim har kigigis. Source number 5. The Aval pi shekvar hikdimu naseh l'nishma. They've already announced their intention. Eager. Now you force them? Shema yuchozer. Maybe they'll be somewhat, what's the word I'm looking for? They will withdraw a bit. Kishayiru ha'esh ha'gedola sheyatza nishmasa. It's one thing to accept an opportunity in theory. Then when you see the fire of Har Sinai, you're a little more frightened. Take a step back. Maybe not Nasa v'Nishma. Maybe Nasa, or maybe Nishma. Because the fire is scary. And Rav Amital saw this Tosfos as a metaphor as well. And Har Sinai was real fire, not a metaphor. There's no fire in the Gush Beis Medrash. You don't have to worry. You don't have to wear your fire-retarding clothing that you all brought with you from your Army-Navy shops. There's fire. There's passion. There's devotion. There's energy. And be honest with yourself. At some level, if you're asking yourself honest questions, then it's very early on. Don't worry if you're not. Maybe I'm dishonest and answering those questions yet, or maybe you're just jet-lagged. Don't punish yourself over. But what does this mean for me? What does this mean about my life? I have a certain plan. I talked about the other trajectory, college, profession, ambition. And all of a sudden, there are these really, hopefully you see us as intelligent, put-together people, visionaries, idealists who decided there's nothing more important than what's taking place on this mountain. They dedicated their lives to it, and they switched their arms to it. Heck, I had that. I remember literally the second day I was in the studio, with my own personal anecdote. I sat down in the lunchroom next to some guy who was speaking English, so right away I found an English speaker. Boy from Toronto, actually. And I say, what's your name? Told me his name. What's my name? Told me his name. Told me my name. He said, Shanaalef, what are you? I didn't hear from Shanaalef that I hadn't met. Maybe a vaunted Shanabeka, one of those upperclassmen. So this is my third year. I looked at him like he landed from Mars. What would anyone in his right mind spend 3 years here?
having been there for the last 35 years. And part of it was, this is your gap year. You come, it's a gap, you get on with your life. But we don't say this is a gap. We say this is reality. Everything else is unfortunate concessions to a world that demands your time and your professional advancement. But it should be the base of Hashem, which we all like to be for eternity. Let's face it. Let's fight it. Existential. It's a fire. But if you're really engaged, what does it take to succeed? Level of devotion, level of commitment, level of interest. It can be frightening. So don't be scared if you're afraid. That's legitimate. And again, Rav Amital validated for us. You're no different than the Jews in our Sinai. They also have that fear. Not just from the fire, but for the connotations of Nelson, but the connotations of religion. Are you going to have to forfeit who you are? You have an identity. You have an ego. You have a life. And hopefully you'll trust us that we're not going to abolish or in any way trample any of those. It's likely what makes this environment, I hope, so successful, because we really respect who you are. And we're not doctrinaire or pedantic. We don't brainwash you. We really want to inspire you. Well, I should say that differently. We don't brainwash you overtly. We brainwash you into believing you're not being brainwashed, and that's probably the best word for brainwashing. Seriously. We're trying not to be manipulative and trying not to all of a sudden rip out the core of who you are, your background, your families, and alter it with some implanted identity, but that doesn't in any way absolve us from asking you and challenging you up the mountain, asking you hard questions. You're going to face some hard questions over the next month. It's our job. So many rebbes in life, so many people in life will affirm who you are. The greatest value and the most valuable people in your life are those who don't affirm who you are, but challenge who you are in a respectful way. Not in a dismissive or disrespectful way. Those are the people you should cling to. People who have the guts and the interest and the courage to question you and say, well, why are you making those choices? And maybe there are other choices that are just as or more important. And again, in a respectful way where it's collegial and friendly and helpful. And when people ask you those questions, you're there and go, just please, we care. It'd be much easier for us not to engage in that type of challenging, experiential process and just teach you and have you clock your time and move on. But we really want to invest in creating your soul and crafting your soul and helping you craft yourself. So this is what Rav Amichal spoke about. I'll just mention one other thing before Yitzchak Levi comes in a few minutes. This is what Rav Amichal spoke about, Aleph Aleph. Recognizing that in general yeshiva is intimidating. Recognizing that it's intimidating in particular for a generation without any background, without any reference point to Torah. Encouraging us to be fully immersed in the yeshiva, delos lithim mehadelos. And I guess my word for that, to modernize what Rav Amichal said, it all comes down to trust. I hope that we, as Rabbanim, are building a credit of trust in your minds and imaginations. And we're not here to push you off of a cliff. We're not subjecting you to challenges you can't handle. They may seem to be overwhelming. They may seem to be intimidating. But we've been here before, and if you've been accepted to this yeshiva, we're going to work with you. We have every reason to believe you'll be successful. And we're not going to be in any way exploitative or manipulative. Once you get past that barrier of trust, and you say, you know, I'm no longer in high school, it's no longer about tests, or about them are not authorities, and they're here to help me. My Rebbe says it's a good idea too, and it makes sense too, and it's wise too, even though it's uncomfortable for me, and I would rather be in a... Let me see what that means. Let me see how that will help. And I hope you're sensing that, not that you're vain in high school with your enemies, but sometimes when you're at that stage and in that framework, it's a bit adversarial, and you have to pass the test, and that's how you see, unfortunately. It's not true, but in some cases you're not able to tap into that. And here, quite frankly, we're trying our best to help you. We're trying our best to craft your neshamas. And there is a fire, there is a passion, and like all fires and passions, it's a little bit scary if you question what are the connotations. However, having said that, and having rewarded the environment of the Beis Medrash, the value system of the Beis Medrash, the intensity of the Beis Medrash, Rav Amichal also warned boys, and I was telling this to his son this morning in our conversation, this is really the third broad Rav Amichal point. Every time I speak to you, and I'll do a lot of speaking about Rav Amichal, I'll try to share with you what he said, and also try to share the broad points that it represented. So one broad point it represented, that Rav Amichal was building a model that was revolutionary. Keep that in your minds going forward. Second broad point is Rav Amichal validated your humanity and its limitations. Keep that in mind, we'll get back to that. A third broad point is this dichotomy between the base medrash world being perfect and the outside world being disdainful and contemptuous and inferior. The base medrash is a teva. The outside world is the wilderness of sin and debauchery. And he didn't have that dichotomy or that polarity. In the world of base medrash, it preaches certain very elegant and important values that may not be that apparent in the outside world. And vice versa, there are dangers in the base medrash also. Don't think it's like you're walking the base medrash. There aren't moral challenges, there aren't flaws, there aren't... A sense of triumphalism or supremacy didn't exist, which does exist in many sectors of the yeshiva world for good reason. It has its benefits, it also has its detriments, and we'll talk about that. But that sense that this is the world of salvation, and the world outside is the world of perfidy, it never existed in this yeshiva, and I think you're sensing the fact that this yeshiva morphed into a community because of that. It's not a yeshiva with a wall, and with a clear dichotomy between those who are in, and whose souls are saved, and those who are outside, whose souls are condemned. That never existed in this yeshiva. So he quoted a Gemara in Sukkah, which we'll repeat very quickly. It also appears in Kiddushin, and it's a chance for me to slip in something which the Kutzker said. I mentioned the Kutzker earlier today in the Hasidic year. The Kutzker is one of the Hasidic masters. Very, very close attention to text. Hasidus in general treated Gemara and Chazal's text with the same precision that we treat Tanakh. So when you read a pasuk in Tanakh and you just had a relief text here, you ask why this word, why that word, but we tend to look at a Gemara and Medrash is more expository. The message is important, but why this word or that word to convey the message is less crucial. Hasidus brought that same textual precision to Chazal that we typically bring to a pasuk in Tanakh. So the Gemara says, Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael, source number 9. In Pagal Hatlacha Menuvel Zeh, if the Yitzhahara, the Menuvel, attacks you, Menuvel means the scandalous one, the degenerate one, if you face the Yitzhahara, Mashcher LeBeis HaMedrash. Run to the Beis Medrash and learn Torah. Torah is the antidote. You've seen this Gemara before, you've heard of it. Im Evan Hu, if the Yitzhahara is as strong as a stone, Yimach, it will dissolve. In Barzahu, if it's iron, misposates, it will explode. Basically, Torah is the antidote to urges, to desires, to uncontrollable vices. The Kutzker asked, why does the Gemara say in Pagabacham Menuvel Zeh? Why the word Zeh? Because one Yetzirah. Hedonism, materialism, greed, sexual interest, and whatever, pettiness, psychological. Why does the Gemara say Menuvel Zeh? In Pagabacham Menuvel, the Yetzirah. What is this Yetzirah? Sounds like there were two Yetziras. So Rav Amital quoted the Kutzker as saying, there's a Yetzirah that you face outside the base matter, so all the challenges we spoke about that you know well. And then there are Yetziras inside the base matter. Minerval Zeh. Just because you enter the world of base matters doesn't mean you're not facing Yetziras. Now you may not be facing the Yetziras of hedonism, of bodily pleasure, of greed, of money, of... But what are the Yetzirah? What are the dangers of being in the base medrash? Well, part of it is exhibitionism. Are you firm just because you want people to take notice? Are you firm in a sincere, authentic way that needs no gratification or external approval? And hopefully we're trying to help you get there. Be authentically from, not because people are noticing or because you're scoring marks or receiving rewards, because it's between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we're trying to help you attain or help you access a very, very deep, authentic, personal, private. I don't have enough time to quote it up in Midrashim that Rav Amital quoted. He spoke about the depression that can set into the business. We talked about that before. It's a very heated environment, a lot of achievers, a lot of, sure, it's a very, very different feel. And many of you, than you felt in high school. Just look around you, look at the talent, look at the sincerity, look at the commitment. That's not easy sometimes. There could be a laziness in the base medrash, either not performing with full, just to skip for a second over to Rav Lichtenstein. I never heard Rav Lichtenstein use the following word. He was such a soft-spoken, kind, genteel person. I never heard him use the word hate. Hate was not in his dictionary. He was not a hateful person. He was not judgmental. He was kind. Just as an anecdote, I think about Rav Aaron countless times a day, and almost all of them is not the Torah he taught me, but the kind person he was. Whenever I try to be a kind person, I think about Rav Aaron as my role model. A kind husband, a kind father, a kind friend, just the kindest person I'll ever meet. That I'm sure. I'll never meet a kinder person. I only heard him use the word hate once.
He said, I hate laziness. He didn't say lazy people, he said laziness. He couldn't say hate people. He was not a minister, he was a lover of people. He was a real humanist in that sense. But he said, I can't tolerate people who are lazy. He just felt like it was such a forfeiture of what it is to be a human being. Just to, again, this is not a Lichtenstein moment, but just, he's giving me the signal. Rav Aaron once said that he never took an afternoon nap in his life. No one should follow through on that example. But could you imagine? He said, whatever strength Hashem gave me on each day, I'll use to its maximum capacity. And I'll go to sleep. The next time you're tired and you're looking for a little bit of inspiration to make it through the day, he's thinking about Rav Aaron who never napped in the afternoon. That's one of Rav Aaron's examples I do not follow through. I'm an active napper still in Shabbos this afternoon, but we'll talk about tired and time management. So Rav Amital reminded people that those are the three broad strokes that I want you to walk away with from this Rav Amital Sikha, aside from the actual comment. Number one, this was a revolution that Baruch Hashem succeeded and has changed the face of worldwide Jewry and certainly in Eretz Yisrael by introducing the model of Hesed. Number two, validating limitations of human being. If you're afraid, if you're intimidated, if it's a little unfamiliar. Number three, the Beis Medrash in the outside world, they each possess their own challenges and dangers, but you shouldn't create a polarity where the Beis Medrash world is a safe haven of religious experience and the outside world is empty or vacant of religious opportunity. I'll stop here. I'll just give a brief introduction. You're going to hear now the Sichat Musar, which I alluded to earlier. Every week we're going to have the Sichat Musar. You're going to hear tonight from Rabbi Yitzchak Levy, one of the Mashgichim of the Yeshiva. Baruch Hashem is with every yeshiva. We're here, as we stress so often, not just to study Torah, but to develop your religious persona and your midos and your commitment. Yitzchak Levy, you probably will not hear a shiur in your life from a bigger tzaddik. So Baruch Hashem, everyone ever listens. Even if you don't understand all the words, just please listen attentively. Also, for many of you, I want you to know, because it's an important issue, and we'll talk about this throughout the year on many levels, about going to Har Habayis, and should you travel to Har Habayis, and what's the Kedushas Mikdash. Yitzchak Levy is probably one of the world's experts, and he actively takes groups to the Har Habayis. So when the time comes, you'll obviously discuss it with us and with your parents, but this is someone you may want to spend closer attention to, if that becomes part of your growth this year. Okay, Yitzchak.